Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
All right, welcome to the show. Season's over, I guess. We our two great hopes that we hyped up all off season, both debuted rather miserably. This was going to be the year of Bill Belichick in college football. This is going to be the year of Arch Manning at quarterback. Guess what? They're 0-2 and a pretty bad 0-2 at that. So it's a good run for this podcast. We got in two episodes. Now we're pretty well done. We may switch to like a home gardening theme going forward, but we will try to persevere. And I will say, gentlemen, I'm here with this is others receiving votes. Sports Illustrated. I'm here with Gene Wojciechowski and Brian Fisher. Again, thank you for joining us. The ratings indicate the season is not over.
Yeah.
16.6 million for Texas Ohio State, which equaled the highest rating of any regular season game last year, the SEC championship between Texas and Georgia. Three other games over 10 million. So I think we're alive and well. But as we're looking for the next hyped hope, we do have a next big thing. We've got Michigan, true freshman quarterback Bryce Young, this year's Arch Manning from a recruiting standpoint, the number one prospect, who gets his first big test this weekend. Looked good in the opener against New Mexico, but now they go to Oklahoma and take on the Sooners. We will pick the game later, but Underwood in that game, 21 out of 31, 251 passing yards and a touchdown. He looked quick. He looked decisive. He's got a cannon of an arm. He's a big athletic guy. He's got a lot of stuff going for him. After we murdered Arch and Belichick with our expectations, what now can we say? How can we practice safe hype for Bryce Underwood? Somebody help me out here. Gino.
Well, I don't think it's over for Arch Manning. I'm sure you don't either. Brian doesn't either. But I have no idea. I mean, at this point, do we really have any idea how Underwood's going to play? I think if last week taught us any sort of lesson is that if you're a young quarterback and you're going on the road for the first time, it's really, really hard. You're right. Underwood looked really good against New Mexico at the Big House. But guess what? This isn't New Mexico, and it's not at the Big House. It's going to be at the Palace, and the Palace is going to do its Palace kind of thing. And Brent Venables is going to throw about 10 kitchen sinks at Underwood this time, and it's going to be tough on him. He did show a lot of poise, and he did make some nice throws, and I imagine that they might run him a little more than they did against New Mexico. But it's still, you know, we'll put it this way. They've been playing varsity football, Pat and Brian, since 1879 at Michigan, and they've only had four true freshmen quarterbacks start a season. So that's not an accident that he's the starting quarterback. He's really good. And as you mentioned, the number one recruit, but this is going to be a different kind of experience for him. And I wouldn't be surprised if he has a Arch Manning like moment or two or three or four in that game.
Well, I think Michigan fans are just happy that they could complete a forward pass and it not be an entire ordeal. Based on what we saw in that opener, given what happened last year with Alex Orji and all the guys that took snaps for them. And look, this is probably less about the moment for Bryce Underwood than I think against the coordinator that he's going up against in Brent Venables. I mean, yeah. He is so good at putting pressure on opposing quarterbacks from where they don't see it, number one, but also from all angles. And, you know, a lot of veterans on that Oklahoma defense, I think they have been primed for this game. They've had it circled on the calendar for a while. They know what it means in terms of the importance on certainly that early season schedule for them. And look, you know, if there's one thing Brent Venables is going to do, it's going to stop the run. And that's going to put even more pressure on Bryce Underwood. I do think, you know, the quarterback run game is going to be certainly an element of this matchup that he's going to bring to the table, but that's not everything that's going to be placed on his table. And honestly, you know, we'll see. I think the hype about Bryce Underwood is not necessarily for this game. It is not necessarily even for this season. This is about building forward for Michigan. And you do like what you want to see, but he's going to end up taking his lumps, as every true freshman is going to do, especially in an environment like this. And I can't wait to see it, because I think this is going to kind of give us a really good indicator in terms of what is that ceiling for Michigan, and ultimately kind of also what is that floor.
You know, you guys are no fun. I mean, Larry Ellison's fourth wife paid $12 million or whatever to get Bryce Underwood in the lineup right away. I think we need miracles. Come on. No, I'm with you completely that this is going to be a different level challenge. And yes, Gene, if last week did teach us anything, it's like expect your young quarterbacks to struggle in big games, especially early in the season, which this is. He threw against New Mexico, and I was just looking at the highlights of his passes. I mean, he threw some great balls, but he threw a lot into traffic. Thrown into traffic against New Mexico and thrown into traffic against Oklahoma are going to be two different things. So we'll see how that goes for him, if he's maybe a little more wary about where he places his passes. But we also have Sherrone Moore coaching this game for Michigan, which is, I think, a bonus for the Wolverines. And one of the, I guess, odd side effects of their very odd case and the odd NCAA ruling and everything that went into the Connor Stallions fandango. Certainly one of the great moments in college football history, where everything that happened with content Stallions. And Shaq, we still haven't even gotten Central Michigan punished yet for him dressing up as a Central Michigan staffer. But the ruling that came down, so Michigan self-sanctioned before the ruling and suspended Moore for two games for this season. The normal suspension is always first two games, right? That's the way these things work. They decided we're going to suspend him games 3 and 4. The stated reasoning was hilarious. Sherrone's an Oklahoma graduate. It's a chance for him to go back to Norman and play against his alma mater, coach against his alma mater. So we wanted him to have that chance. That's touching. That's a lovely sentiment. I still don't think you should get to choose your games based on where you went to school, that you are suspended for NCAA violations. The unstated reason, I suspect, in this is that Bryce Underwood, they figured, was going to be their starting quarterback, and his first road game against a ranked SEC team, they'd probably rather have his head coach there with him than not. So that's my thoughts on that. I found the whole thing quite funny, and good for Sherrone that he gets to go back and, you know, dab the corners of his eyes when he hears Boomer Sooner. It's going to be a lovely, lovely thing. Brian, what do you think about the fact that Sherrone Moore is coaching in this game?
Well, I can't believe, like, you know, like you were saying, I can't believe that Oklahoma is allowed to, or Michigan is allowed to get away with this going into this Oklahoma game. And look, it does kind of make a farce of the system itself. But hey, this is what you do, I guess, when you can impose your own violations and your own sanctions in the NCAA parlance. And I think it's going to be fascinating, because look, you know, Michigan's undefeated with interim head coaches. So maybe it is better if Sherrone had been on the sidelines, you know. Now that we think about it, I mean, they did lose 5 games with him last year. So there is that factor. You know, I'm just more curious, because he is heavily involved in the offense. Like how much of a difference is he really going to make on those sidelines, given everything a head coach has to be aware of? Is this more of a staff thing almost, so that there are more dedicated resources there for Bryce Underwood, so your quarterback's coach, your OC, can really get down and dive into some of the details that they're going to be seeing in the game? I think that's probably going to be the bigger picture. picture why Sharon is around, so that he can kind of take that off of the offensive staff's plate, to where he can focus on making those in-game decisions, when to go for it, when is third down, when you got to be aggressive, when you got to be a little bit conservative, especially on the road against an SEC opponent. But it is just, I think it's Michigan at its peak in terms of the hubris that they had as a university going throughout this entire process, really the entire last couple of years. I think this is kind of the cherry on top in terms of seeing Schroen more on there. And you're going to see a graphic, I'm sure, on ABC or ESPN in terms of saying, all right, he's suspended for the next game for NCAA violations. Like that's just going to be a perfect encapsulation of the system at this point.
Pat, first of all, your cynicism is staggering and I love every bit of it, but yes or no, the NCAA could have told Michigan to go pound sand on its dates, right?
Yeah. I don't know why they didn't.
So I don't have a problem with Michigan trying to push the envelope there, trying to get the penalty that they wanted to get. And they pulled it off. The NCAA could have said no. In fact, the NCAA went a step further and suspended him another game for next season when they could have done it this season. So I don't fault Michigan for trying. I love sort of the ballsy attitude of it. The NCAA could have shut it down right away, and it didn't. So this is what we get.
Yeah, no, this was in their control, and they failed to. They let Michigan dictate the terms to them, which is remarkable. And yes, the third game suspension for next season was another mind-boggling element of this.
Yes. But,
and Michigan is, of course, they are appealing the ruling here with the NCAA, even though it was largely favorable. And we got a wonderful word salad from Ward Manuel about how the fact they even brought up a postseason ban is ridiculous. Well, you didn't get a postseason ban. You got a massive fine commensurate with a postseason ban, but you're allowed to play. So the whole thing is hilarious to me. It's not the only appeal Michigan has launched. Jay Sean Barham, their excellent linebacker, maybe their best player, was ejected in the second half against New Mexico for targeting. So he will sit the first half of this game. They appealed that. Big Ten said, no, thank you. You're out. A lot of people did not like the targeting ejection. If you read the rule, I think there is grounds to eject. It is forceful contact with the head or neck area of a defenseless player with the head, shoulder, forearm, fist. And he did hit him with the head. He didn't lead with the crown of the helmet. But he did. So I don't think it's a bad suspension. And I don't think it was a justifiable appeal. And I'm glad it got shot down.
I don't disagree with, I mean, you can definitely make the argument that he should have been ejected, that it was, targeting, forceful, all those things. But it is that specific hit. It's a gray area to me. I mean, you could argue it was a football play. I mean, he form tackled him. He turned his head at the last second. Had they said it wasn't targeting, I would have understood. But at this point, I don't understand half the time what's targeting, what isn't anymore. Sometimes I'm completely convinced that was targeting and they wave it off. In this case, I wasn't sure. And I'm still not sure. But the guy who came in for him, Cole Sullivan, he had five tackles, an interception, and a sack. So maybe they're okay for that first half. He played well against New Mexico. But again, it's New Mexico.
Yeah. Well, glad they got another appeal in there at Michigan. So
you're crazy.
All right. As for Oklahoma, the other side of the coin here, a huge season for the Sooners. Brent Venables, year four, years one and three, not very good. Year two, good. Needs to have a good year four here. They changed just about everything around him going into this season. New offensive coordinator, new quarterback, Arbuckle and Mateer both come from Washington State. Venables is now calling the defense. Jim Nagy is in as general manager, and they brought in a whole front office staff with him. So they're doing everything they can to make Brent Venables successful. What is you guys' prognosis for how Oklahoma is going to do this week and this season? We'll pick the game at the end, so we don't need to get into that. But what's the thought about Oklahoma this season and long-term in the SEC, Brian?
Are they making all these changes to make it easier for Brent Venables or make it turnkey to have a new person come in? I think that's a larger question kind of hanging over this as well. But in terms of the here and now, I mean, you win this, you win the Jackson-Arnold Derby in a couple of weeks at home against Auburn. You're looking at 5-0 going into Red River. And I think that's obviously a huge game in terms of the rivalry, in terms of the results that Brent Venables has had against Texas the last couple of years. You know, look, it's still a team that is, I think, capable of beating a lot of those middle of the pack or even kind of, close to upper tier SEC teams. I mean, you look at South Carolina, Ole Miss, Tennessee, Alabama, Missouri is on that schedule. Those are, I think, winnable games if Oklahoma plays up to their talent level that they've had, especially now that they have an offense that looks like it has a pulse compared to last season. You know, yes, LSU is going to be a tougher game this year, but it's not crazy to think that this could be a team that flirts with 8 or 9 wins, especially given how good Brent Venables has been on defense. You know, that puts you in territory where you're kind of flirting with a playoff bid, or at least in that discussion at the end of the year, which is, I think, where Oklahoma ultimately wants to be. Now, I think the bigger picture is, how is all this change externally from the football program, really going to affect one of probably the bedrocks of stability in college sports? You know, how are they going to handle having a new athletic director who's probably not going to come necessarily from the, athletics world? Maybe more of a business sense. Certainly that's been the talk there in Norman, being more of a business guy. You have a new GM in terms of Jim Nagy, as you mentioned, a newish president who's still adapting to, I think, putting his imprint on the football program, on college athletics in general. So there's a lot of change. And, can this still be a team that contends for an SEC title, or at least challenges to get to Atlanta come November every year? Maybe not every year, but I think they can be consistent in terms of having some of those years where they are in that contention and they are in that window. But I think the days of consistently winning 10 games, I think, is out the door, certainly in Norman. And, that's a fact of the matter based on their new conference and based on, kind of recent results that we've seen out of the program.
Yeah, Brian, I don't think the ceiling is 8 games or 9 games. I think they could win more than that this year, I think I would not want to play OU this season. I think they have an incredibly talented roster. I think Venable's defense, he's calling the plays, as Pat mentioned. I think that system has been in place now for a few years. They've got the talent to match the scheme, and they certainly have the quarterback, the Heisman-caliber quarterback now. So I think they're set up for success. And, yes, that schedule does have a lot of muscle tone, but as you mentioned, there's no reason why they can't run the table early and go into Red River with a lot of confidence. Long-term, I don't see why they can't be successful on an annual basis either and be a perennial CFP contender. I mean, they have a lot of things in place now, and they embraced the SEC. They're not scared of the SEC. The one thing I will say, though, is you had Joe Castiglione as AD, and one thing about Oklahoma, and he was in place for a long time, they always had that stability. They had a president for a long time, an AD for a long time, and a head coach for a long time. And I'm talking about the Stoops era. And they've had some upheaval in recent years. So they were their most successful when they had that stability. And I think they're going to want to try to find a formula to replicate what they had before.
Yeah, no doubt. They had what coaches love to call alignment, right?
Yes.
And now it's going to be differently aligned. And I think it's going to be difficult. I think I land a little more with Brian in terms of, I think, year in and year out, being able to be in the top 4 or 5 in the SEC. That's tough to do. I mean, you're talking I would say the permanents are Texas and Georgia. I would have said Alabama, but we're going to have to rethink that. But still, Alabama is not going to stay dysfunctional for long if they are indeed dysfunctional. We won't declare that for sure after one game, but those three. Florida is not going to stay down. Tennessee is not going to stay down. So there's 5 right there. Oklahoma, can they join that group? Yes, they can. Can they join that group consistently? I don't know. It's a lot to ask. And it will, I think, depend largely. Do you get the right coach? Maybe Brent Venables is the right coach. We don't know yet for sure, but if he's not, then can the next guy be the right coach? And can you be lucky enough to get a Bob Stoops who stays for that long? I mean, that was incredible. You know, I'm not sure the Bob Stoopses are still going to be part of college football going forward. So fascinating times down there, and I think a really interesting game. I'm looking forward to this one because I'm not sure what to expect from either team. I think they will both be significantly better than last year, but where that lands, I don't know.
But do we agree that Venables, I mean, this is the make or break season for him.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. No doubt. Yeah, absolutely. Now, where's the make and break line? I don't know. Yeah. You know, is it you got to be at least 8-4? You got to be 9-3? I'm not sure. And it's against the schedule that is brutal. So anyway, you're a great quarterback matchup, Underwood against Mateer. Fascinating. We'll see if it's a great one, but it's fascinating for sure.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Your kids could get free or low-cost health coverage from Medicaid or CHIP. Even if you've applied before, they may be eligible now. Kids up to age 19 are covered for checkups, vaccines, dentist visits, hospital care, and more. And if they already have Medicaid or CHIP, remember to renew every year. Visit insurekidsnow.gov or call 877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Speaking of quarterbacks, Seth Wickersham, our friend from ESPN, has put out a great book, American Kings, on quarterbacks and how they're made and how they work and why they succeed. Everything. A fine Missouri graduate, Seth, as well. That needs to be noted at all times. But in there, he had something. We've seen a couple of excerpts, and one of them was talking to Sean Payton, who knows a thing or two about quarterbacks, and he had a formula when looking at drafting for what's going to succeed. And Gene, you took this formula and I think you applied it to the current college game. It's scary when sports writers do math, and we are mathing here, so beware. But you got some interesting information. Tell us what you found out.
Brian, can't we just have a Mizzou-free zone podcast one time? Do we always have to?
No.
Yeah, I did the math. I actually wrote it all out here, and that's scary in itself. But yeah, Seth's book is fantastic. I recommend it to anyone. But what he basically did is he went to Sean Payton, the Denver Broncos head coach, and Payton had put together this formula that didn't necessarily take into account the positives of a quarterback. Instead, he wanted to know what the negatives were and then how that quarterback reacted to that negativity. Was he able to minimize the mistakes and maximize the solutions, especially at the line of scrimmage? And so basically it's a fairly easy formula. He took interceptions, sacks, and fumbles, divided it with the total amount of pass attempts. I did not include fumbles. I checked with Seth to make sure would the results still be mostly accurate. And he said that the fumble percentages were so low that it really wouldn't affect the overall outcome. So we're going with that. So just to give some context, Bo Nix was at 2.3%. Okay. The lower the percentage, the better. Patrick Mahomes was at 8.1%. Caleb Williams was at 17.5%. So take Bo Nix as the gold standard at 2.3%. Mahomes, really good at 8.1%. So I applied it to the quarterbacks that what the books are saying are the top 10, nine quarterbacks in the Heisman race right now. Do you want to, either one of you want to venture a guess who came in with the lowest percentage according to Sean Payton's formula? And I'm using their career statistics, including week one stats.
Boy, it's not Lenora Sellers. It's not Garrett Nussmeier, I don't believe. Drew Aller?
He came in third at 5.5%. Brian, you want to give it a go?
I don't know. I mean, I would say Cade Klubnik, but like, you know, he did have some turnovers, especially, you know, if you're talking career numbers, you know, early in those days, especially as a freshman, like he had a couple of turnovers. So I don't know about Cade Klubnik, you know, in terms
came
of the top
fourth.
Guys.
Came in fourth at 7.23. Number one just had a nice game against the Notre Doters, Carson Beck, 5.2%. And Nuss came in at second at 5.4%, and Drew Aller came in at third at 5.5%. So really respectable numbers using Sean Payton's formula. Arch Manning, granted, not a lot of data at this point, but 8.0%. Sam Leavitt, number six, 9.2%, Gunnar Stockton, 9.3%, John Mateer, 10.2%, and Lenora Sellers came in ninth, 13.6%. So take the numbers for what they are, but they are an interesting indicator of what Payton at least deems really important when he's assessing quarterbacks.
Yeah, I find it really interesting. The old, you remember Harvey Pinnock, the great golf coach, who said it's not how good are your good shots, it's how bad are your bad shots. And this is kind of that, right? Like, how many double bogeys are you committing out there? And I do remember
in real time.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And I do remember Drew Brees, you know, at times saying an incompletion's always better than a sack. Anything's better than an interception or a turnover. And so I can see that formula, you know, from Peyton Breeze fitting with these guys. This will be a great stat to watch as the season develops, I think, really? You know, how these guys either get better or what happens when they play better competition and so forth. Carson Beck, I've waxed and waned on him. You know, I go up and down. There are times I think he looks great and times I question his decision-making, but clearly his decision-making in these terms is not that bad. So this will be fun to watch. Thank you for your math, Gene. Appreciate it.
I sure hope it's right.
We'll get a fact checker on your ass
please,
here.
Get one.
Yeah. We have a huge budget on this show, so we'll have our army of fact checkers and statisticians follow up on that. I hate to do this, but we're actually going to math some more here. We're going to do a little more math, or at least talk about it. With the ACC 8-9 game conundrum, they are on the clock now that the SEC has finally decided our long national nightmare of listening to them dither back and forth between whether they're going to play 8 or 9 games has finally ended. In 2026, they're going to play 9. And so now the ACC is the last of the power conference group to still be playing 8. Everyone assumes, well, they'll just go to 9 to go along with everybody else, and they need the bump, etc. But there's problems here. The math does not math well for them. There's 17 members. You can't play a 9-game schedule with 17 members and have it actually work out right. There is the Notre Dame dynamic. They play a minimum of 5 games against Notre Dame every year. What do you do with those? Could those be counted as conference games? If they go to 9, some schools will play Notre Dame, and some schools every year have an SEC rival that they play at the end. Florida State plays Florida, Georgia Tech plays Georgia, Louisville plays Kentucky, Clemson plays South Carolina. So how does all this work? Where should they end up? ACC, there's meetings expected later this month. ADs where I think they're going to really dig in on this and may come to a decision. We'll see. But I think Jim Phillips is pushing them towards a 10 power opponent schedule. What exactly does that look like? Does that look like 8 league games plus 2 others, or is it 9 plus 1? And do you end up with some playing 11? And is that a problem? And then are you losing home games, which drives ADs shiveringly into the closet, like we can't handle not having that home revenue. So a lot at stake here. I'm not sure really where this is going to go, but I'm fascinated by it. Brian, what do you think? What do you expect?
Yeah, I would be surprised at this point, like you said, that if the ACC in the next year or two is not committed to playing 10 Power 4 games, you know, whether, as you mentioned, that mix of conference versus non-conference, I think is going to be up for debate. But, you know, obviously math doesn't help them in terms of being a 17-team league. And I think how you get over that hump is going to take up the vast majority of the time. More than anything, the ACC doesn't want this being held against them, you know, in terms of, all right, you're the lone holdout. You're the guys that are only playing 8 conference games. And you know, frankly, they understand that, like, look, that 8 conference game slate is probably not as difficult as what you're going to see in the Big 12 or in the Big 10 or in the SEC. And so I think it's kind of taking away a bit of a data point in terms of, hey, we're still with you guys in terms of playing a difficult schedule. We know the CFP metrics that are coming into vogue now that the committee is going to start considering are going to have more of an emphasis on strength of schedule. So the ACC doesn't want it held against them. I think that's the biggest thing in terms of exploring this move, whether it's to 9 games, whether it's sticking with 8. And I think there's the other component too, is that they've got to make sure that they are getting rewarded for if they do add conference games in terms of that money from ESPN. Like, this is the same kind of conversation and debate that the SEC had. You know, we're not going to do something out there for free. You know, maybe there is a way if you have more games like a Miami versus Florida, you know, Georgia Tech versus Auburn, Clemson versus an Oregon, you have some of those marquee games that you can add to the schedule that can generate additional revenues. That's going to be the name of the game for the ACC. And I think that's ultimately probably going to drive the decision, whether it is adding another conference game. And we've seen even non-conference games in the ACC recently, but, or if it's, hey, let's get another marquee opponent on there. Yeah, it's going to make life more difficult for your head coaches, but that's kind of the name of the game at this point in terms of the race for the playoff and in generating more revenue. And I think that's going to be key for the ACC moving forward.
They played 8 conference games last year. How many CFP teams did they have last year?
Had 2. Worked 2. Pretty well.
Worked pretty well.
Yeah.
And they're playing, if you look at their schedules this year within the ACC, their teams are playing a lot of P4 teams.
Yeah.
So I think someone's going to have to convince me why it makes more sense to go to a 9-1 as opposed to staying at 8 conference games and playing 2 more Power 4 opponents. And Pat, you would know this, living in Louisville. Would a game like Louisville, Kentucky, just go away if they went to a 9-1?
Yeah, that would be a disaster.
Would some hard decisions have to be made relative to rivalries? And you're also going to have to explain to me why Clemson would go for this. And they have a little more clout than a lot of the other teams in that conference now. So I don't see the logic of bumping up to 9. For all the math reason that you mentioned, Pat, and just from the way it's worked, it seems to be going just fine. So convince me otherwise. Otherwise, I think you just stay at 8 and go do the 8-2.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you that there's a lot of reasons to stay at 8, but there's also peer pressure. And we have seen 8 versus 9 used as a cudgel to beat the SEC on the head. And that's the SEC, yeah, which plays, you know, and is a demonstrably more difficult league. So I agree that I think you can make a case for staying at 8 as long as you make sure that everyone schedules a minimum of 10. The other problem with that, though, is there's fewer non-conference games to schedule. Okay, there are fewer opponents out there now that the SEC has taken away 16 of its non-conference games and made them conference games. So a lot for them to consider. I am sure that, like, Memphis and South Florida have an easy mathematical solution for this. Just add us and you got 18 teams.
There you go.
Not sure that's going to happen, but I would imagine they'd like to offer that helpful hint.
Well, I mean, is this a leverage point to get a 6th game out of Notre Dame? That could be another, you know, sure, negotiating ploy.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's an interesting point too, is, you know, Notre Dame's good for the league, but Notre Dame's also good for Notre Dame. This has been good for Notre Dame. So can you leverage them to do a little bit more on behalf of the conference that they are a member of in every other sport other than like hockey? So,
well, there's one, I mean, isn't there like one year where they're 5 and another year they're 6 and they go down?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it fluctuates.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they have the outside the ACC agreement is the Stanford game, which is also up for negotiation coming up. The Clemson series that they've just, you know, extended for, I think, almost a decade. I mean, that is outside the ACC agreement. So there are kind of a pseudo 6 game for Notre Dame. If you count some of those games in the standings, you throw in Clemson and Stanford. All right. Well, there's 8. You can almost keep it and count your Notre Dame games. And there you go. But, you know, I think it's going to be a fascinating debate amongst the jockeying factions in that AD room in terms of, and look, they've all just kind of come to the table and sing kumbaya recently in terms of agreeing on the revenue changes, agreeing on all these changes. And now there's this other controversial topic pops up. I'm going to be very curious to see what the mood in that room is amongst those ACC ADs in terms of moving forward with this.
Yeah. The kettle's always boiling in that league, which is one of the reasons it's interesting and fun to follow. I said at the beginning of this show that we have basically, the season is over, we've given up, and that's definitely the mood in a few locations around here. But we know it's not really true, or is it? So we're going to do a little hold 'em or fold 'em here on 6 entities that got off to a not very good start to this season. The question's going to be, are you holding your cards with them? Are you sticking with them? Or are you folding, throwing in, and giving up the hand because they are done? So the table stakes are high here. You know, what is your expectation going forward for these folks? And we are going to start, of course, with Arch and the struggles he had against a really good team in Ohio State on the road. Brian, you were there. You watched the whole thing. What do you think? You holding or folding with Arch?
Oh, I'm definitely holding. You know, it was funny watching him pregame warm up. You know, he was like very focused, you know, had a great throwing motion, like, you know, a picture perfect. All right, that's what a quarterback looks like. And then the lights came on, and it was certainly a different story against that Matt Patricia defense. But I'm still holding. I mean, keep in mind that Texas, as bad as Arch played, you know, overall in terms of his level, still had a chance with, you know, 3 minutes left in the game to still win it, you know, or at least tie it there at the end. So I think Arch will be fine. They will get back to putting up some good numbers these next couple of weeks. The SEC slate is not as difficult as some of the others. Yes, they do have to go to Georgia, but I still think the internal hype around Arch, I think it can still be realized. I think they will get him back on track moving forward. And I think it's definitely a hold'em type of situation, even though maybe talking about him in the Heisman race and all that sort of stuff, we can probably fold on that.
Well, obviously Sark has to bench him. Warby Parker has to pull those ads. Of course we're holding him. What? You can get rid of Arch Manning, give up on him after one game where they lost by 7 points at Ohio State? No, of course not. By his own admission, Arch Manning said he didn't play well. Sark said he didn't play well. Anybody who has a television set knows he didn't play well. But he has 3 games coming up against easy non-conference opponents and a bye week to get it together, and he will, and he'll be fine. You know, he's a good quarterback. He's just a young quarterback who's making his first ever road start, and he's making it at a really tough place. So I totally expect major improvement from him, and I think we're going to see a different version of him 4 weeks from now.
Yeah, I'm with you guys. I'm holding on him too. That was a tough assignment. As we mentioned, not just the opponent and the venue, but I did go to Ohio State practice in mid-August, and at that practice, the defense dominated. And I came away thinking, oh, man, Ohio State's in trouble because I'm a dumbass, and I don't think of the defense actually just made the offense look bad. I'm only thinking, oh, my gosh, the offense looks bad. The line is overwhelmed. Julian Sayin's not that good. No, their defense is great. Their defense, their secondary is outstanding, and the guys that they have plugged in up front look really good. Sonny Styles is a first-team All-American, I think, going into the year, and I would say that is reinforced after the first game. I was surprised that Arch missed on a lot of crossing routes, including the first pass of the game, which they set up nicely. You know, waggle action, you got your layers of guys going across, and he throws it 3 yards short in the dirt. But then he missed some other ones, including one late, different pattern, but still those crossing routes and going both directions, right and left. I think that's the kind of thing you can clean up easily enough. You know, that's nerves and pressure and whatever may else have factored in. But no major concerns about Arch Manning as a quarterback going forward. And, you know, I think the quarterbacks have evolved so well that you lose track of going back. And again, this is old guy radio here. Sorry. But as a Bronco fan, watching John Elway struggle incredibly as a rookie. I mean, he had games, he was 6 of 20. He couldn't do anything right. And Joe Montana, when he played at Notre Dame, would be terrible for three quarters and then pull it out in the fourth. And it looked like Arch was going to do that. It really did. He put it together, made some big-time plays there in the fourth quarter. So,
Pat, yeah. I covered Elway when he was a rookie for the Denver Post. And Elway lined up under the guard one game.
He did. So yes.
It happens, man. It just happens. Yeah. Things, and it was on the road. It was against Baltimore. It just happens to the very best of them.
Didn't you cover Johnny Lujack as a rookie?
No, stop it. Stop it. I'd rather hear you talk about Mizzou again.
All right. Holding or folding on Bill Belichick. And I will lead this one because I was there for that, and it was a god-awful disaster. I mean, I can't imagine – I can't remember another really hype debut that went as badly as that one did. The first 6 minutes were great, and then the last 54 was the worst thing I'd ever seen. I mean, it was incredible. They did nothing right, offensively, defensively, special teams. So – that was something, and I, the best part of it was going down to the post game after this debacle, and you walk into the Keenan Football Center, and they do their media there, and they've got all these chairs set up, and they got the Carolina backdrop, but framing the Carolina backdrop is all these festive balloons like it's a high school prom, and it's like, that would be weird if they had won. After a loss, it looked really weird. And having been around North Carolina a lot over the years, it's not really a Carolina kind of thing to do. Bill Belichick, I don't think that's a Bill Belichick thing to do. I wonder who might have influenced the interior decorating there. I don't know. I'm just curious. Anyway, hold or fold on Bill. I'm folding. I'm sorry. That was so bad. That was so bad. They got a chance to win their next two games. They're playing Charlotte and Richmond. I don't know. I don't have the schedule in front of me. If they've got Wake Forest or Stanford, so those are teams that look bad enough, they may be able to beat them. But, oh, boy, that is a mess, and it's going to take a lot of work to improve that. I'll open the floor. What do you guys think?
Well, it did look like there should have been corsages available in the balloon area. That was awful. I would argue that might be one of the three most embarrassing losses in Bill Belichick's storied career. It might be the most embarrassing loss, given the amount of dignitaries that were there, ESPN's hype of the game, for all the obvious reasons, and then just to get boat raced like that. It wasn't that they just lost. It was how they lost and how they looked during the loss.
Horrible.
So I'm not folding on Belichick long-term at Carolina if he sticks around to see this through, but I'm definitely folding on this season. They're still going to win some games because that schedule is so hysterically soft, but that program, and Pat, I'm with you 100%, it's in a bad way right now, and I can't see it getting a lot better by the end of the season.
I think I might be the lone hold here, both this season and moving forward. I mean, this is kind of Belichick's MO. You look back at his NFL tenure, you know, he used that kind of first quarter of the season to kind of get to know his team a little bit better. You know, they understand what buttons to push, you know, how we might best scheme up some of these guys, how we might cover up some of these flaws. And I think he even kind of made that approach almost to this opener against a very good TCU team. I think that's the other thing that I think gets lost in all the shuffle is, like, TCU, true, legitimate Big 12 contender, maybe kind of flirting with playoff. Obviously, they won 9 games last year, brought back a lot of that team. So, like, this is a very good opponent that they went up against. I don't think that has kind of been taken into account. And look, 70 new faces, like, you're not going to necessarily know what's going to go on with those guys. And so I am still going to hold, yes, I think they'll get back on track these next couple of weeks. And look, the ACC schedule is pillow soft in terms of what they got to face this year. They miss all those top tier teams in the ACC. I think Bill will get them playing much better in the next couple of weeks. And I think they can take some of that momentum back into conference play.
Let me just say they don't have good players and they weren't well coached. That's what killed me, and that's what really shocked me was,
yeah,
like
it was an execution thing, like that to me was the thing that I think stuck out watching it at home. And maybe Pat, you got some more insight into this, but like they just didn't execute outside of that opening drive. And I think that if you're talking about a Bill Belichick coach team, something that can change it's going to be that execution component for a lot of those.
So I would hope his son, the defensive coordinator, can coach up his linebackers to make a run fit. They were just running up into the blockers and getting plowed, and they were running lanes that were 8 feet wide. It was like they did not even practice run support for the linebackers and safeties all year. I was shocked at what we were looking at there.
Offense, first drive, beautiful.
Yeah.
And then it's like someone kidnapped the team after that, and the proof of life newspaper photos. It was horrific. I'm glad I wasn't there. I watched it. I'm glad I wasn't there.
Well, I said in the press box beforehand, and you guys know this. This is media mentality. I said train wreck or juggernaut, nothing in between. And we got the train wreck, so it was good to write about. You know, that's what we look for. We want extremes, and we got an extreme there.
Got it.
Speaking of extremes, Alabama. Oh my, oh my. All the talk about how much better they were going to be in year two under Kalen DeBoer, and they open with a face plant against Florida State, who really might be much, much improved. Certainly look the part, but still a 2-touchdown loss in a game they were a 2-touchdown favorite. Bama, Gino, are you holding or folding on Bama?
This feels a lot like the Billy Napier situation last year, where the donors are already calculating the buyouts, and we're already listing who are the odds on favorites to replace DeBoer, and then Napier got it together, and the Gators actually finished strong, and there was this optimism, and now it feels like Florida's sort of turned the corner. I wonder if that is the same sort of situation here. I'm going to hold them, but it's with an asterisk. I think we're dangerously close to a tipping point with this program and with DeBoer. They're going to win the next few games. They get a bye, and then they head into Georgia. And to me, that is a game that is going to help determine the fate of DeBoer. Because if they go out there and they lay another Florida State game, I don't know how you come back from that. But if they at least play like a Bama team, not like what we saw against Florida State, I think there's hope. So I'm gonna hold on to them right now.
I'm holding too. You know, and you look at the high end that they are still capable of. They've still got the talent. You know, they still got a good coach that has win as one of the highest percentages of any active head coach at this point. Like this is a team that, you know, still can accomplish their goals this season, even though they looked really bad in that opener. And look, you know, the issue is not that the high end, it's not about competing against the Georgias and LSUs of the world. It's about competing against the low end. It's about getting up for those games that you know you're going to win by double digits. And that's a leadership thing on the team. Like it's not a talent issue at Alabama. It's a leadership issue there within those players. And they've got to take some responsibility for this too. I know there's a lot of focus on Kalen DeBoer, but it's also on those players as well to step up. You know, when you get pushed around physically like they did against the Noles, that's on those players. They are capable of much more and they know it. And I think that's going to be the big thing for Alabama moving forward this season. You know, are those players going to start taking leadership? You know, it was probably understandable last year in terms of, all right, we don't know what buttons to push in terms of, suffering a loss to Oklahoma or Vanderbilt. How do you respond to that in game? I think this is on the players, I think, to turn things around almost as much as it is the coaching staff there at Alabama. I'm still going to hold just because of the talent level and the fact that you know those are good coaches on that side of the ball. But, this is a team-wide thing for Alabama. They can still get back to where they want to be in contending in the SEC. But I think that was more of a wake-up call there in Tallahassee more than anything.
I'm going to hold barely. Like, we go one more round and somebody ups the ante, I'm folding. I'm holding reluctantly at this point.
Yeah.
Because that was very discouraging. And, Brian, I think your point is good about the players, but then also it does – the mentality there always started with the head coach. And I don't think the mentality is urgent enough and has enough edge. I wasn't there. None of us were there. But watching on television, I saw what I heard A.J. McCarron, the former Alabama great quarterback, say on the radio earlier this week. Where's the sideline juice, man? I watched guys in the third quarter making effort plays, breaking tackles, gaining extra yards, and there's like two guys on the sidelines clapping, and there's 30 guys just staring. Like, I just don't get the lack of intensity, the almost like we don't. It looks like they don't care. I'm sure they do. You wouldn't have gone through the offseason that players do and then get to game time and decide you don't care. But that's kind of what they're projecting out there. So that's a tough thing to fix. You can't necessarily just go in and find an intensity, I don't think, as easily as you can fix schematic things. So I'm reluctantly holding.
And, Pat, to that point, you almost wonder – And Brian's right. DeBoer is a magnificent coach. I mean, his record speaks for itself. But is there a little bit of a substitute teacher mentality? Yeah. You know, you've gone from Saban, and I don't want to – I mean, that was last year. You can compare him to Saban last year. I get it. This year is on him. And yep. And I just wonder if, you know, we had the principal – as our head coach for so many years, and now do we have a substitute teacher? I don't think that's the case, but I think you can ask the question.
Sure. I mean, they at least project that as a potential explanation for this. So fascinating to see. Clemson, I was there for the game against LSU. A lot of it was ugly. Some of it was good. But I'm holding on Clemson. I'm not folding after a loss to an LSU team that I do think is just significantly improved defensively. They were not good in the second half. I was not a Clemson lover going into this season. You know, I didn't really see how a team that didn't beat much of anybody last year was suddenly going to jump up and be a national championship team. But they're not a bad – they could still win the ACC, and they could still make the playoff. So I am – holding, but I was, you know, I had low expectations or relatively low expectations for Clemson to begin with. What about you guys?
I'm the same. You know, I still think there's a team that is still top 10 caliber, you know, like they've got the talent. I think more questions than you probably had after coming into the season in terms of the offensive line, in terms of the run game, just kind of disappearing, especially in that second half. I mean, you know, it seemed like you have one wide receiver go out for a hamstring injury, and then it seems like the whole offense just kind of shut down. I think they will be much better moving forward. I think they will get back to their Clemson ways. And look, Dabo just finds a way somehow, you know, like every single season, you know, at the end of the year, he's in contention. He's there, even if he might not have the team necessarily to compete. So I think ACC play will be beneficial to Clemson. They'll get back on track. I'm still holding. And I still think because they are such a veteran team, like in moments like this, it can kind of rally the troops a little bit, get them more focused on what they have to do week in and week out. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if you kind of see Clemson there coming out of the ACC title game at 12-1 and looking more like the Clemson we kind of thought they were going to be coming into the year.
Well, in our preseason show, I took Miami to win the ACC. It was nothing against Clemson. It was just more my belief in Miami. But I'm here at the University of Tennessee. I'm teaching classes this academic year and did it last year also. And I got to tell you, after listening to Dabo and his grading, he said he said that LSU got a 65 on the exam and Clemson got a 58. Someone needs to help Dabo with his grading acumen, because I had LSU a hell of a lot higher than a 65. And I thought it was great the way that Brian Kelly kind of clapped back at him. I think good-naturedly, but with a roll of the eyes, Clemson got, LSU beat him fair and square. And they exposed some of Clemson's weaknesses. And the things that we thought might be strengths for Clemson weren't necessarily strengths that night against LSU. So I'm not giving up on Clemson. I'm holding on to them. But it was funny to listen to Dabo's grading system.
Yeah, you'd get called into by the dean to discuss why the heck you were giving out those kind of grades. If
58.
Yeah, 65.
What a curve. What a curve.
And it did, it did bring back salty Brian Kelly, which I'm always in favor of,
Absolutely.
Nice Brian Kelly is unnatural. So let's bring back the sassy Brian. So that was a good exchange there. Speaking of Brian Kelly, former coach at Notre Dame, the current Notre Dame team did not get off to a great start. Good game. Brian, you were there sweating in the humid South Florida tropics. You holding or folding on Notre Dame?
I'm definitely holding. I mean, the lack of touches for Jeremiah Love, and especially in the first half, was just puzzling to me. That was almost a game plan loss. And look, CJ Carr, I think everybody had some high expectations coming into the game in terms of how he would play at quarterback. I almost think he exceeded them, especially in that second half, rallying them and making some big time throws, including that one on the busted coverage down in the field. I mean, he impressed me, I think, at quarterback, and I think the Irish are going to be fine. We know they're going to rally. I think Marcus Freeman is a great head coach. You could see last year in terms of using losses to kind of fuel them the rest of the way. I think the way that Notre Dame came back in this one, I think they're going to use that moving forward. And look, you look at that schedule, they're going to be a home favorite there against Texas A&M in a week or two. And look, the schedule, it sets out well for Notre Dame to go back and make another run like they did last year. I am definitely holding on the Irish. I think they will be just fine as long as they start force feeding the ball to Jeremiah Love instead of giving him only 14 touches in a game.
Pat, you got better hair than me. Why don't you go ahead?
I do. That's true. I would say I'm certainly holding on Notre Dame. It was a little bit disappointing in some areas, but they'll be fine. The one area of concern for me is the schedule, which Brian said is manageable, but it also doesn't present a lot of quality opportunities. So I think the Texas A&M game now looms very large next week. If you lose that and you're 0-2 and you're looking at Purdue, Arkansas, a disappointing Boise State, NC State, USC ? BC, Navy, Pittsburgh, where are you going to get quality wins? So I think they are not quite must-win territory from a playoff standpoint against A&M, but darn close to it. So they'll use the off week and get better from this. Marcus Freeman does tend to bounce back extremely well from losses, and I expect that to be the case here.
They lost to Northern Illinois last year. They end up in the playoff. This is a much better loss than NIU. I did love that Sean McDonough, during his game call, when Jeremiah Love carried his, oh, there's Jeremiah Love back from the witness protection program. I'm like you, Brian. It's like, well, is he still on the roster, right? We can still hand him the ball. So yes, you're going to see a lot more of him. CJ Carr didn't throw downfield much, but I think he showed a real toughness. And I think if you're a Notre Dame fan, or if you're a Notre Dame coach or one of his teammates, you had to be impressed with what he did. But to your point, Pat, you're right. The schedule, while they might be favored in these games, I don't think they're going to be favored by a lot against A&M. That bye week will help. We'll just see what happens with it. I'm holding on them too, but they've put themselves in a tiny bit of distress.
Yeah, I agree. CJ Carr, I think, exceeded expectations and showed some character and some clutch down the stretch. All right, last on our hold 'em and fold 'em, probably the most important one, the Oregon Duck mascot, Puddles. This is a tough debut, guys. This is a tough debut. He goes running out for their game against Montana State. He trips, and he loses his head. The head, the big duck headpiece falls off. And there's nothing worse if you were a mascot than to be sitting there unmasked in front of an entire full stadium, and especially the duck, because the duck is a real sassy dude, man. And all of a sudden, there you are out there looking like Joe College student instead of Puddles the Duck. How bad is this? Does this guy have to fold? Does he have to leave school? That's my question.
This is the second season in a row that Puddles has lost his head. And there is no worse cardinal sin as a mascot. And wait, Pat, didn't you do a, weren't you the cardinal tree or something one time?
I was the Stanford tree once.
Stanford,
yes, I was.
Tree, yes. This is like catching Mickey Mouse smoking a cigarette behind Cinderella Castle. You know, like the headgear is off. He's you know, you just don't do it as a mascot. So, Puddles, one word for you, Velcro. Try it. It works.
I will say maybe you can blame it on a little bit of jet lag, because he was at game day earlier that morning celebrating Lee Corso and saying goodbye. So maybe we can blame it a little bit on the jet lag in terms of not having that head secured. But, you know, I'm definitely holding. You know, Puddle's one of the best mascots in all of college football. And I can imagine that if not next week, that, you know, maybe a week after that, you know, he's going to use this to advantage. He's going to have like four different heads. He's going to like be swapping them out, you know, each quarter. Like he's going to use this to his advantage. And I think that's why we all love Puddles and what he can do.
Well, I love Puddles because he once sprayed silly string on Pete Thamel on live TV. That's why I love him. But if I no, I'm sorry. I think he needs to transfer. I think we need a backup Puddles. I think this is the capital crime, and there has to be some consequences. So we'll see. We'll see how Puddles shows up here.
Mascot on mascot punishment from 40.
That's right. Draconian. All right, Winners and Steak Dinners, our weekly pick'em contest. There's clearly already been cooking of the books because somehow Gene has the best record. Stop the steal. We need an exam. We need a forensic audit here. Gene's 4-2. Brian's 3-3. I'm 2-4. I'm terrible so far. Hopefully that gets better this week. We're going to pick four games against the spread, and then we're going to each have a lock of the week. Let's try to breeze through these relatively quickly. Starting with the big game of the week, Michigan at Oklahoma. Michigan is getting 5.5. Gino, where are you going on this?
Brian, I just want to remind you of something that Pat said last week about the TCU-Carolina game. I don't think there's any way Belichick comes out with an unprepared team. The scary part is I was thinking, you know what? He's absolutely right. There's no way he's going to come out with an unprepared team. This is a tough, tough game. 5.5 points is a lot of points to give to Michigan, but I'm going to go with OU, lay the points, based mostly on the combo platter of John Mateer. I like his experience. I like what Venables might be able to do against Underwood. Home game, I think the Pows is going to be rocking. I'm going to take OU and lay the points.
I'm going with Oklahoma as well, and for a lot of the reasons that Gino just mentioned. I mean, look, you know, true freshman, first road start, like that is a recipe for disaster, especially against Brent Venables in that defense. And look, Oklahoma, not just John Mateer, Jay not supposedly healthy for this game. He was very limited in terms of his touches in the opener, so I think he will be good to go. That is a very dangerous backfield, especially given what we know Bill Biedenbaugh can do with that offensive line. So give me Oklahoma at home, and a weird number at 5.5, but that's almost Vegas kind of telling you, hey, watch out for this game. This something could be a little crazy there in Norman.
Yeah, I hate to go along with you guys, but I'm taking Oklahoma here. It is a squirrely number, but true freshman, first road start, Oklahoma looks – quite good. I mean, they didn't play anybody, but still, I think that's a way improved team. So I'm going to say Oklahoma wins by a touchdown. So I'm going with the Sooners there with you all. All right. The Cy-Hawk, Iowa at Iowa State. Kent, producer Kent, can you please play the music?
Hooray! We love it in the city of A.
Hooray!
We love it in A.
There we go. They'll be ready. They'll be drinking that tap water. They'll be probably be drinking a lot of other stuff too. Natty Light, Bush Light, God only knows. But great annual series. The Cy-Hawk, they have a trophy. They play each other in every sport that they both have, and they keep score all year, and somebody gets a trophy at the end. This is just a fun rivalry, and I think two pretty good teams. We got Iowa getting 3.5 on the road in Ames. Hooray. Brian, where are you going?
I'll go with Iowa getting the 3.5. I think the hook in particular kind of makes me lean towards the Hawkeyes just a little bit. I mean, this is always a close series. It feels like it's always coming down to the fourth quarter, somebody making a field goal, missing a field goal, something like that. I think these two teams, they enjoy playing against each other. I think the conservative nature of both coaches is going to play into this one. So with that hook, give me Iowa getting the 3.5.
History tells me I should take the Hawkeyes. They've won the last six games in Ames. They've won seven of the last nine games of this series. And as Brian said, there's that hook. But I'm going to go with Rocco Becht, and I'm going to give the 3.5. I love the way he's playing. I just think it's time for Iowa State to win this one. They end the streak of Iowa.
I like the way Rocco Becht is playing. I thought he made some gutty plays at the end against Kansas State and Ireland. But I'm taking Iowa. I think Iowa can win out right here because here's what I expect. They brought in Mark Gronowski, the quarterback from South Dakota State, and he did nothing last week. And I wonder if that's partially by design, that we're not even going to really break him out if we don't have to. If we can
have
run.
You watched Iowa's offenses in the past few
years?
Oh,
yes, I have.
Okay,
oh, yes.
So maybe that wasn't by design.
Maybe not.
Trust me. Was a very typical box score, you know, like run 300 yards and let's throw for 50, you know.
I did say that when I saw the box score that you don't change Iowa, Iowa changes you. And Mark Gronowski was changed into a pedestrian.
That was a great line.
Quarterback. But I'm expecting more. I think they will break it out a little bit more and they'll win the game. So I'm taking the Hawkeyes, not just to cover, but to win on the road in Ames. All right. Another old rivalry game that unfortunately doesn't get played much anymore, but it's back. Which is great. The border war, Kansas and Missouri. If you grew up or lived in either state from 1895 through 2011, you probably had feelings about this. And in fact, if you lived in either state for the 40 years that preceded that, you probably had feelings not related to football, but related to the Civil War and related to the fact that a group of Confederate raiders from Missouri went in and burned Lawrence to the ground. In 1863, if you burn somebody else's town to the ground, grudges ensue. And so there has been a grudge between these two schools forever. They stopped playing in 2011. They're back now. I think it's fantastic. This game is in Columbia, Missouri. Kansas 2-0. Missouri is 1-0. Kansas is getting 6.5. Gino, your thoughts?
Well, the real upset is that you didn't say I was there in 1895. So I appreciate that. I took Kansas as my surprise team in the Big 12, so I feel like even though my brain is telling me take Mizzou and give the points, I'm going to stick with Jalen Daniels. I'm going to take the 6.5 and hope.
Well, I'm leaning more towards the home team instead of just hope and a prayer. I think the reliance of Kansas on Jalen Daniels to be that team, to be that offense, Mizzou can kind of take him away just a little bit. I think that does give them enough headroom to win by more than a touchdown at home. So I will go with Pat's Tigers there in this very important rivalry for both teams.
And for Pat.
And for Pat.
Pat is not going with Pat's Tigers. I'm taking Kansas and taking the points. I think this is a field goal game. I think it's going to be really close. I like what Kansas has done so far. I do think Jalen Daniels is an incredibly dynamic quarterback. And the problem with Missouri, having watched the first game, they got skill talent, man. They've got it. But the offensive line got their quarterback hit a lot. Bo Prabula was really good, Penn State transfer, but he took a lot of hits. They've moved their All-American left guard to left tackle, and it's been a struggle. And it's going to be probably more of a struggle when you're not playing Central Arkansas. So I am going to take the Hawks to cover and the Tigers to win. All right, South Florida at Florida, another neighborhood scrap, not really a rivalry, but it probably means a lot more to the Bulls than to the Gators, but the Gators probably better be ready because South Florida was very good in thumping Boise State. Bulls getting 17.5, pretty big number. Brian, where are you at with this one?
Give me the Gators in this one, and I actually don't think that USF, despite the scoreline of that game against Boise State, played as well as that final score would actually indicate. I mean, there were a lot of red zone possessions that came up for the Broncos, so I think Florida ends up putting those into the end zone. I think this is a very much a disparity between the talent of an SEC team and what USF has, despite all that, a lot of veterans, a lot of people that are going to be excited to play there in the swamp. Give me Florida, even though they got that big number. But 17.5, they covered at home.
Do the Gators peek ahead to LSU and Miami after that? And the answer is no. I think South Florida has their full attention, and I think they cover in this one.
Yeah, I'm actually going to go with you guys both here and take the Gators as well. South Florida was a +3 turnover margin against Boise, and I don't think they're going to get 3 turnovers out of Florida. All things being equal, Florida is going to be a lot better and should be able to roll in this one. All right, lock of the week. We each pick one game independent of each other that you like here. Who's got a lock for me?
I'll go. Did anybody happen to see the little Dan Lanning Mike Gundy catfight recently about assorted resources at their program? If there's any question if Lanning's going to take his foot off the neck of Oklahoma State in that game, it just disappeared. What are they getting? 29.5, did you say, Pat?
I think so. It's a big one.
Well, you didn't say. They're getting 29.5. Oklahoma State is. I think Oregon State and Puddles blow past that.
Well, and it was quite the week for Mike Gundy too, with the commercial that he released on the the rant. So it was Gundy's been in the news this week. So he's definitely going to get it handed to him, because not only is Dan Lanning going to get that entire team fired up for him, but he's going to make sure the starters are in an extra series or two just to get a few extra scores on Mike and say, here's what we're paying for, and here's how it goes. I'm going with my lock of the week. We talked about it earlier. North Carolina giving 13.5 at Charlotte. Was not impressed by the 49ers in that opener against App State. I think, who, regardless of the quarterback issue, I think that's kind of why this line is probably as small as it is. I think that's probably playing into the hands of North Carolina. Give me the Tar Heels to cover by scoring 2 touchdowns on 49ers.
Holy moly. I mean, look, I thought Charlotte was bad too, but I just don't know how you can have any faith in North Carolina on a 5-day turnaround, no less. We'll see. All right, I'm one more neighborhood scrap where I'm going for my lock of the week. Baylor at SMU, old Southwest Conference rivals. They're playing in Dallas. SMU's only given 2.5, and I didn't like what I saw out of Baylor in the opener defensively. I think SMU has the weapons to take advantage of that and to certainly win by a field goal or more. So I'm rolling with the Mustangs there. Last thing. Before we go, and we'll let the audience mercifully move on here, for the Exxon Valdez, as it's pulling into port for this show, we've got to talk about a class action airplane lawsuit over window seats that don't have windows. This was filed Eastern District of New York against Delta by a guy, I think, named Nicholas Myers. And the argument here is that Delta sold him seats that it billed as window seats, and there was no window. There was a wall there, right? Not every seat. Sometimes you get in, there's a wall. There's not an actual window. And so he is suing Delta for false advertising, claiming that, and it's a class action suit. He's trying to drag everybody he can along with him. And saying that Delta needs to actually give you a window if they sell you a window seat. Gene, you're a frequent flyer. How do you feel about a Delta window seat that isn't a window seat?
So this is like obstructed view seats at a stadium. Is that what you're saying?
It is.
Well, I say sue. Not because I think it's, I mean, it is, it's a ridiculous suit, but I have spent, and as have you guys, spent my life flying. I've eaten so many alfalfa wafers and spam chips and cheeses from North Korea, the stuff that they serve me on a plane. You know, my hometown airline, the motto is, we landed. What else do you want? So I say anytime we have a chance to stick it to the airlines, let's go for it. I'm rooting for you. Send me a letter. I'll sign the class action.
Wow. Vigilante Gene going Thank after you. Him.
Well, I'm going to recuse myself since my wife works for an airline, but I will say that, you know what, there's definitely some merit to the suit in terms of the marketing of these windows. If there's not one, you shouldn't be asked to pay the extra fee. They do nickel and dime you so much nowadays. If you don't have elite status, you can't choose this window seat. You can't go in the front of the plane. Like there's definitely some aspects of flying that were not as good as they were, you know, 5-10 years ago. So I think there's some merit to the lawsuit. I'll just say that in terms of the marketing of some of those window seats. But I'm more concerned about the window etiquette that some people, especially in the middle seats, are paying nowadays. Like, I mean, if you are in the middle seat, you do not have access to the window. Let me make that abundantly clear, especially after a couple of flights this past weekend. If you want to ask nicely and say, hey, can you pull down the shade so we can see things for landing or on approach or whatever? Totally fine. I get that. But if you're reaching over the window to pull down the window, that is a big no-no. And I think that is more cause for concern and more of need of a lawsuit is those middle seat people that think they have access to the window. That to me is a bigger issue than what this lawsuit is bringing up in terms of the class action.
You've hit a hot button there. First of all, yes, if I'm in the window seat and you reach over and put, no, we're going to fight. We will fight right then and there.
I get some looks this past weekend. Let me just say that.
Secondly, though, mankind spent how many million years bound to the ground, unable to get up above the ground? The last 100-plus years or so, we've been able to fly and get up and see what the Earth looks like? And you want to pull down the shades? You don't want to see the Earth? What the hell? I do not understand this obsession with everybody pulling down the shades in the middle of the day. You're flying into someplace. Brian lives in Salt Lake. It's one of the most beautiful places to fly into and out of. And they're pulling down. So, well, I got to see, you know, season 2 of Landman here. I got to be watching that. I can't look outside at America. It drives me completely crazy that people pull down the shades all the time on the damn airplane. So that's a separate point. As for this, Justice 40, I'm with you guys. Stick it to the big airlines. Take their money if you can get it. I'm sure this suit will be thrown out in about 4 minutes, but it's worth a shot. So, all right, that's our show. We've gone on too long as it is. Thank you for listening. Please subscribe. Please find us on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, whatever the case may be. We'll be back next week. We'll try to do better. The season is not over after all. Enjoy the weekend.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.